I'm Janet O'Sullivan, Vice Master at Selwyn College, and I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you to this year's Ramsay Murray Lecture. It's the latest in a series that we owe to the generous bequest of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Ramsay Murray, a loyal alumnus of Selwyn. His brief for these lectures was helpfully broad, that they should be on a subject of military or historical or general interest. And our speaker tonight, Professor David Reynolds, is exceptionally qualified to fulfil Lieutenant Colonel Ramsay Murray's wishes. In recent years, we've very much enjoyed hearing about Barack Obama's legacy from Theda Skopel, about Putin's Russia from Bridget Kendall, and last year, a fascinating glimpse behind the headlines in the Middle East by Frank Gardner. Tonight and other events we do underline our commitment at Selwyn to adding insight and learning that help our understanding of the wider world. We're a strong community and one that is resolutely not insular, not least because our students and colleagues come from all over the world. To give just one example, we have a thriving Russian academic visitor scheme funded by another generous donor. Do look at our events and our outreach activities on all our social media outlets. So anyway, the title of tonight's lecture is History, Academic, Personal and Public. And the blurb tells us that Professor Reynolds will explore some of the achievements of academic history today and also reflect on what can get lost if history becomes too academic. It is hard to think of anyone better placed or qualified to reflect on those issues. David is a hugely distinguished historian, a fellow of Christ's College, Professor of International History, and a Fellow of the British Academy. His many critically acclaimed books include The Long Shadow, The Great War in the 20th Century, America, Empire of Liberty, A New History, and In Command of History, Churchill Fighting and Writing the Second World War. Of that last book, the New York Times reviewer said, "Despite the Hall of Mirrors' quality of In Command of History, a historian writing about another historian writing another book, he has produced a fascinating account that accomplishes the impossible. He actually finds something new and interesting to say about one of the most chronicled characters of all time." David is also notable as a TV historian and documentary maker for the BBC, writing and producing scholarly but accessible and entertaining histories of the 20th century, reaching way beyond the lecture or supervision audience. Now, it may just be the turbulence of modern times, but I sense contemporary commentators reaching for history more than ever before, both to explain current events and seek precedent for ways forward, whether it's comparing the European revolutions of 1848 to the Arab Spring, or Sir Robert Peel's difficulties over the Corn Laws with, well, you know what I'm going to say there. So in an era of fake news and revisionism, when a significant minority of Europeans do not believe the truth of the Holocaust, and a significant minority of Americans believe the 9/11 attacks were staged by their government, the importance of a reflective and knowledgeable guide to the past has never been greater. Finally, my colleagues will tease me for quoting from an unusually lowbrow historiographical source, but I particularly like these words spoken, indeed sung, by the Wizard of Oz, in reality a salesman from the Midwest, in the popular musical Wicked, on being accused of not telling the truth in his account of past events. He said, "Where I'm from, we believe all sorts of things that aren't true. We call it history. A man's called a traitor or a liberator. A rich man's a thief or a philanthropist. Is one a crusader or ruthless invader? It's all in which label is able to persist." So in the sincere hope that he will be able to tell me whether I should believe the Wizard of Oz or not, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome David Reynolds to give tonight's Ramsay Murray lecture. He's just informed me that it's particularly poignant because he is retiring at the end of this term, so we are all the more grateful to have him here. After the lecture, my colleague Mike Sewell, our senior tutor at Selwyn, will be on hand to guide you and David through any questions you'd like to ask and the answers that he wants to give. David.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I've attended a number of Ramsay Murray lectures over the years and thoroughly enjoyed them. And It's now interesting to have a chance to be in the opposite position from the audience. One of my colleagues said to me, he was not able to come to my valedictory lecture, which put me in mind of a story that was told of Lord Halifax, or Lord Irwin, as he then was, who was Viceroy of India in the late 1920s. And in those days, in the summer, you retreated up to Simla in the hills to get away from the heat of Delhi. And when he arrived and when he left, there was always a great paraphernalia of official welcoming and farewells. And on one occasion, Irwin spoke to the station master, who was dressed in formal regalia and very impressive, and thanked him for being so courteous and so on. And the station master bowed deeply. He said, "My Lord Viceroy, it is always a pleasure to say goodbye to you." Now, I was under strict instructions about what I couldn't do in this lecture. I was told not to recycle some talk I'd already given. So that pretty much ruled out talking about Stalin's correspondence with Churchill and Roosevelt, which I'd been involved in writing a book about, the Kremlin letters. And anyway, I thought, Stalin is not a very pleasant topic for a Friday evening in the spring. I have been working on a book about thinking about Brexit in the historical long durée. But then I thought, does anybody want to hear about Brexit on any evening? So you won't be hearing about that. Though it is fair enough to say it is, of course, a serious topic. It will be with us for a very long time. And as a suggestion, maybe for the 2026 Ramsay Murray lecturer, possible title, Brexit, Reflections on the First 10 Years of Negotiations. Anyway, what I want to do this evening is to talk more lightly, but I think with seriousness, about some reflections on the state of history today. So this is very broad brush. Any of my colleagues here will, I think, probably find it very dubious at times. But anyway, it is my valedictory. And by that, I'm talking about history, academic, personal, and public, meaning the general state of our profession. Personal in the sense of what we bring to history as individuals, as historical beings living in time. And then thirdly, with regard to the public side of it, what I feel are our responsibilities as scholars to the general public in this age, as you say, of fake news and all the rest of it. I feel very positive about the state of academic history and its range, its fertility. I feel concerned that we may be squeezing out of our students and potentially our readers their more personal feel for history. And I'm also concerned, particularly at the time of the Brexit furore and so on, which has shown how much history can be abused, that we scholars are not sufficiently engaged in public debate about the nation's past and the world's past. So, history, academic, personal, and public. What strikes me is the variety of history now on offer, variety in chronological depth and global breadth, but also the range of methodologies that we use, the approaches to teaching and research. The history faculty, is now engaged in a substantial review of its Part One teaching, but whatever you think of the merits of the TRIPOS at the moment, it's certainly much more wide-ranging and lively than it was when I did it as an undergraduate nearly half a century ago. And it's interesting to reflect that most of my undergraduate work then was on the 16th and 17th centuries. I was an early modernist. To give you a flavour of how the discipline has moved on, I want to share with you some comments from the 1960s made by a very, very distinguished historian, a Regius professor, no less, though from the other place near Didcot. Now, I'll just warn you that this is a health warning, really. You may be shocked. You may be distressed. But here we are. Undergraduates, seduced as always by the changing breadth of journalistic fashion, demand that they should be taught the history of Black Africa. Perhaps in the future there will be some African history to teach, but at present there is none, or very little. There is only the history of Europeans in Africa. The rest is largely darkness, like the history of pre-European, pre-Columbian America. And darkness is not a subject for history. Please do not misunderstand me. I do not deny that men existed even in dark countries and dark centuries, nor that they had political life and culture interesting to sociologists or anthropologists. But history, I believe, is essentially a form of movement and purposive movement too. We should not neglect our own history and amuse ourselves with the unrewarding gyration of barbarous tribes in picturesque but irrelevant corners of the globe, tribes whose chief function in history, in my opinion, is to show to the present an image of the past from which, by history, it has escaped. Or shall I say, to avoid the indignation of the medievalists, from which it has changed. Hugh Trevor Roper, BBC, Radio 4, or whatever home service was in those days, in 1963. Well, we've moved on a long way, and I think in a purposive and productive way. And I want to just share with you for a minute or two a couple of examples from our own faculty. I know there are other history faculties in the country, but, you know, it's a domestic evening. And I want to share them with you just by looking at the website. This, of course, is now a possibility of a technological problem. We have a very helpful aide on board just in case. So let me just bring this up. So here is the Happy People on the History Faculty website. I became aware of some of these examples of the fertility of what's going on in the faculty when I was chair of a few years ago. It was one of the many, many innumerable pleasures of doing that job. The way our agenda as historians has expanded owes a lot to discovering new sources, or rather realizing that apparently unlikely things could be historical sources if we think about them in the right way. Take, for example, parish registers, recording information on births, marriages, and burials, which parishes have been required to keep since, I think, 1538. Now, for years, these registers were a favourite haunt of genealogists, but their potential for demographers has been systematically exploited with the aid of modern computers by the Cambridge Group for the History of Population and Social Structure. Let's see if we can get this over. I've lost my mouse. Can you help me find my mouse? This is the cat, okay? Just need to. Are you in here? So that's the Cambridge group. I think at least one person here this evening is very much associated with it. Was it founded by Peter Laslett and Tony Ridley in 1964 to think about family history, demographic history, and indeed pioneering much of this work. One of the results of it was a classic volume, The Population History of England, 1541 to 1871, which has been beloved by now several generations of history undergraduates here. Over the years, the group has branched out into other areas from demography. They work now on history of energy use and so on. One of the most interesting and, I think, active areas is the occupational structure of England, a project that they're looking at over four centuries or so, I think from the 14th century up to the 20th century. And the work they're doing has changed our understanding of the Industrial Revolution, it's changed our understanding of women's work, and it also is enormous fun. So this is one of their interactive maps that you can use. It shows the development of the economy, the labour force in agriculture and mining, the labour force in the secondary sector, manufacturing and construction, and in the tertiary sector. And I'm now on, I think, the secondary sector. And you can follow this right along a timeline. So you can start in 1600, where there isn't an awful lot of manufacturing going on. You can click along to different points, and you can catch what's happening in the 19th century, the 20th century. The darker the bluer, the redder bits are the ones where there is more going on. They show, for example, how much manufacturing was going on from quite an early stage, a surprisingly early stage in the 18th century. And you can click onto your favourite area. There's York, for example. That's the state of the secondary sector at this point. It's a sort of great tool for people who are trying to find an excuse not to revise or not to mark their exams, or you can play with it endlessly. But, I mean, you can imagine to do that, to provide that kind of a map, is, of course, a huge amount of work and, of course, some very, very intelligent IT as well. So that's one, I think, fascinating example. Let me give you another one, totally different, which is the history of material culture. Now, some of you are very familiar with material culture. Other of you may not have heard the jargon word before. But it's really saying, let's think about things, not just texts, and try and understand them and their meaning historically. And this is a discipline that's developed over recent years. It owes a lot to archaeology, anthropology. It's an integral part of our faculty now. A number of academics in their research and their teaching show what we can learn from insightful research into dress, food, furnishings, and the like. And some of you may have seen this particular exhibit at the Fitzwilliam Museum a few years ago, Treasured Possessions, which was a collaboration between historians from the faculty and curators from the Fitzwilliam, looking at these objects, thinking about what light they shed on the early modern period right up to the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, the consumer development of consumer society, and so on, accompanied by a very lovely glossy book by three of the curators. And this, again, opens up a completely different area. It takes objects like this out of the domain simply of the auction house and thinks of them in terms of their value for historians, helping us to understand a new world of goods, the flow of different kinds of goods, literally from the new world. It helps them to think about the process of acquiring things, of developing dress, habits of consumption, So this is, again, very illuminating, and it rests on the idea that there are other sources than simply old-fashioned political documents. Now, these are just two examples. They're ones that strike me as interesting, and I could pick on others. But this is this kind of work, which is now part of our faculty and of many history faculties, is an example of, I think, the fertility of academic history. But, and this is now to move on to the personal dimension that I want to talk about, I'm not sure that all this vitality always feeds into the way we teach students, particularly at the postgraduate level. There I fear that sometimes historical study seems a rather desiccated business. Maybe it has something to do with the emphasis now on training, a fixation of research councils. In my day, there were no master's courses, no training. One just got on with things and learnt from one's own mistakes. Somehow I've muddled through, but that was how it was done. Reading some dissertations and some undergraduate essays now, I fear we may be squeezing out of our students the sense of sort of imaginative excitement about the past that animated them originally, that got them into studying history, of wanting them to come to Cambridge or other universities. And we're in danger of creating trained but identikit kind of young scholars. Because for me, the personal element of doing history is fundamental. I'm sufficiently old-fashioned to believe that we historians do have some agreed methodologies for distinguishing what we write from fiction. Yet I'm sufficiently influenced by postmodernism, by poststructuralism, to acknowledge that everything we do write is in some sense a personal construction. And more than that, I actually relish the fact that a different person who is viewing the same evidence as me will come to different insights and may well draw some very different conclusions. And what I want to do is encourage students to use their individuality, to use their imagination by looking at sources, to bring them alive and bring them alive in different ways from me. So there's the subjectivity of the historian matters. An aging pale male in Cambridge can learn from the writings of, say, a young black female in Atlanta or a middle-aged scholar in Beijing. That, for me, is fundamental. But also, and this is a further point, the pale male changes over time. It may mean he just becomes a stale pale male, but hopefully growing older should expand one's understanding of what it is to be human. And this is what I think our discipline is at root about. And I want to illustrate this for a few minutes, if I may, by resorting to an autobiographical example. But it's a story. It's a story of a book which I think helps me to convey a sense of what I'm trying to talk about when I talk about this personal dimension. A quarter of a century ago, I published a book about US soldiers in Britain during the Second World War. This is the military bit now. It was called Rich Relations, The American Occupation of Britain, 1942 to 45. The subtitle was a play on the famous British wartime complaint that the GIs were oversexed, overpaid, and overhere. Less familiar is the American riposte to that the Brits were undersexed, underpaid, and under Eisenhower. The word rich in the title is a deliberate pun. It's about America's comparative wealth, but also about the richness of the relationships, about what Churchill already was calling the special relationship. Now, this book took a decade and a half to between conception, if you like, and completion. And that wasn't, I think, because I was lazy. It was because a couple of other projects intruded along the way. But there was a real benefit to that. because in the process the book changed profoundly, and I think for the better. And let me explain two reasons why I think this happened, because they underline for me what I'm trying to say about the importance of sources and of personality. The book was about Yanks and Limeys. It was about relations between the British and the Americans. But I was conscious that there were many other contingents, Allied contingents in Britain at the time during the Second World War, and I thought it would be useful to look at one of the significant ones of those, the Canadians, as a kind of control, because they were obviously part, in some senses, of the common culture, yet with a fiercely different sense of their own national identity. So in, I think, late 1990, when my wife and I were spending a semester at Harvard, I went off for a couple of weeks to the National Archives of Canada. And I looked in the relevant military archives about Canadian soldiers in Britain, and I found out quite a bit about, you know, their pay and their attitudes, British people and so on. But I kept, in these files, kept coming up against references to the Dieppe raid of August 19th of August 1942. And I was aware of this raid, but some of the things in the documents just really began to bug me, worry me, in the way that those of you who are researchers know there are things that, you know, just start to niggle you. And very fortunately, in Ottawa, the National and National Archives are in the same building as the National Library of Canada. So I was able to shuttle up and down the stairs, good exercise, looking at books to try and find out more about the Dieppe raid, and then going back and looking at my documents. And as the what was to me the enormity of what I was reading in the files gradually caught my hold on me, I was just engulfed by a sort of wave of what I would call archival anger. It's kind of the historian's equivalent of road rage, I think. But when the documents get to you. On the 19th of August, 1942, troops of the 2nd Canadian Division mounted a raid on the port of Dieppe. For most of them, this intended day trip turned out to be a one-way ticket. Nearly 70% of the Canadians ended up killed, wounded, missing, or prisoner. In terms of the size of the force involved, it was probably the most substantial losses of any Allied assault in the Second World War. To the historians of the war, of course, the Dieppe disaster is familiar. And at the time, it became clear to me, most of those in the know could see this disaster coming. There'd already been one attempted raid on Dieppe in July, which had been aborted after the Luftwaffe bombed a couple of troop ships. So the chances of surprise were pretty minimal. And when the operation was remounted in August 1942, the British Army wouldn't touch it with the barge pole. Montgomery, who was the commander then in the... is this me? No, okay. I thought I might be getting a warning from the Ministry of Defence. Sorry. Montgomery, who was then commanding troops in Kent, wouldn't touch it, as I say. Yet, it was clear from the documents the Canadian commanders in Britain were insistent that their troops must be given the lion's share of this action. Why? That's what began to bug me. And what I've discovered looking at the documents was this, really, and it became a chapter in the book. Many of these young Canadians had been in southern England waiting for war for nearly 3 years. If Hitler had invaded in 1940, there would be two Canadian divisions on the North Downs in Surrey and Hampshire against him, something we often forget in our finest hour. Three years training for a battle that never seemed to come. Hitler didn't come to Britain. We didn't go to the continent. cooped up in drafty barracks in Aldershot, without adequate recreational opportunities, often getting into drunken fights with British soldiers, running out of all the various training routines that their officers could think of. By the spring of 1942, in fact, psychiatric cases reached what one medical officer called epidemic proportions. And these were ascribed to boredom, separation from families, inactivity, and indefinite waiting. Fast forward to late August 1942. Reports about the troops involved in that raid indicated that survivors were dazed and shocked at the loss of so many friends, but inspired and almost jubilant by the whole experience. Postal censors reading mail from all the Canadian units in Britain to folks back home stated, after the raid, the morale of all the troops was considerably enhanced. There is a feeling of pride in themselves, and the sense of frustration has been dispersed. So, choking back my archival anger, I felt I'd stumbled on a terrible truth, probably familiar to any military person, but it was new to me. Canadian commanders felt they had to sacrifice hundreds of their men in order to save their army. And as I brooded on this lesson from the Ottawa archives, I was forced into new and much wider reading in secondary books. And that's a process that I'm sure is familiar to most of fellow historians, that the engagement with primary material forces you to rethink your projects and look at things that you never thought would be important. And the lesson of Ottawa, for me, was summed up in a line from the military historian John Keegan in his book, The Face of Battle. And this line became one of the epigraphs to Rich Relations. Inside every army is a crowd struggling to get out. Inside every army is a crowd struggling to get out. And the task of those who put on what Keegan calls wonderfully the mask of command, an act well known to all chairs of faculty, heads of houses, vice chancellors, and so on, anyone who put on the mask of command, their role is to prevent an army reverting to a crowd. And that's the real function of all those jargon words like discipline, morale, pride in one's unit, loyalty to one's mates, the kind of things that seem pretty sort of bizarre or kind of crass to people outside the system. But to those involved, they know that without inculcating an intense sense of group identity, the individual instinct of what you might call sauve qui peut will triumph at moments of crisis. So army and crowd, institution and human beings. My electrifying confrontation with those sources in Ottawa transformed that book. It had previously been conceived as an analysis of how the British government, the US Army, dealt with some of the problems posed by having, if you like, a kind of an overdose of testosteronic young American males in the UK. Problems like the clash of cultures, the excess wealth, the gendered encounters, racial friction, and so on. But taking seriously the crowd inside the army made me see things from the soldier's point of view. I mean, you could ask why the hell I hadn't done that before, but anyway, you know, I woke up. And as a result, the book became both top-down and bottom-up, examining that set of issues, first from the standpoint of officialdom in one set of five chapters, and then through the human experiences of men and women, British and Americans, in a parallel sequence of five chapters. The first set were called High Policy, the second set, Real Life. But being, if you like, electrified at the source, as one might say, was not the only reason why this book changed. Because Rich Relations had been conceived by a 25-year-old junior research fellow and was eventually delivered by a 40-something university lecturer. And over those years, not only the project, but also the author had changed. More specifically, in the space of just 3 years, I'd become a father and had lost a father. Fortunately, in that order. And this gave me a new and visceral sense of the words life and death. So I began to understand the GIs in wartime Britain, not as abstract sources on a page in musty files, but as young men living life to the full because that they knew that this year might be their last. And to keep me earthed in that feeling and that recognition, I periodically visited places that sparked my historical imagination and touched my human emotions. So, for instance, we took a former US airman from Memphis, Tennessee, then in his 80s, back to what remained of his base near Lavenham. We stood in a decrepit farmyard near 100 yards or so of former broken up runway. He completed 25 missions on a B-17 bomber over Germany, which was a rare achievement. Many of his buddies did not survive. We stood silently there for perhaps about 15 minutes. I didn't intrude on his memories. My wife didn't, nor did his family. Then he murmured something banal about how it had always seemed a long way cycling back to his base from the pub in Lavenham. There's little more to say. I sat on the beach on the seaside at Saint-Laurent-sur-Mer in Normandy with Margaret as our two-year-old son played with his bucket and spade. Saint-Laurent is better known as Omaha Beach, now stripped of mines, barbed wire, Rommel's asparagus, as it was known. It's a beautiful stretch of sand, maybe 400 metres at low tide. But as I watched Jim digging away happily, I could not help thinking of all those young men on the 6th of June 1944 who landed on that beach and never became fathers. Closer to home, I would occasionally go to Madingley Cemetery to feel the graves and reflect on the close encounters of GIs and Brits in their wartime moment. During one such visit, on a grey, frosty day in, I think, February 1993, I saw suddenly a bright floral tribute on one of the graves. And suddenly that random gravestone was transformed into another electrifying source. And with tears in my eyes, I remember very vividly pulling out, I found a bit of paper in my pocket, and I jotted down what became the last lines of the book. Those were really important experiences in making that particular book. What I'm saying is sources are not history. Sources are what we as individual human beings make of the material we find. Indeed, whether we discern from any debris from the past the potential for them to be sources for us, to inform us. And those judgments are peculiar in many cases to individuals as individuals. And they require an act of imagination. Good history is not a matter of laying out the sources, offering long quotes or paraphrases, as I fear one often does in PhD dissertations. It's about bringing those sources and materials to life in one's head and in one's writing. Indeed, I often now say to people who work I'm reading, I can't see that. I can't see this. I'm meaning, I can't visualise it in my mind's eye. And often all that's required is actually to add a few apt adjectives or something like that just to start bringing the thing to life. So I believe that being personal in a controlled way is vital in a historian. Daring to apply your imagination as a full human being to the sources you discover. Heaven forbid we train that out of our students. But writing history is not mere personal indulgence, self-indulgence. And I'm moving on now to the public dimension. It's about education and education in the broadest sense, taking seriously our responsibilities as scholars to the wider public. Now, I've had the opportunity, Janet kindly mentioned, to engage in a bit of connection with a wider audience by doing some TV documentaries and radio programmes. There was absolutely nothing preordained about this. It just happened, entirely thanks to ex-students. All the TV films I've done have been directed by a former Christ historian. I was his DOS about 30 years ago. And someone I supervised for US history when he was an undergraduate at Keyes later became controller of BBC Radio 4. And he was the one who invited me to do a history of America. So just a moral here for colleagues, be nice to your students. You never know how they'll turn out. And I think if I reflect on the things I've done, what I've tried to do in the media work is twofold. Challenge some of the contemporary clichés about the past. Because so much of what we read in the newspapers is simply recycled clichés. And I believe profoundly that doing history is a subversive activity. But doing that in a vivid and hopefully engaging way. One veteran TV director warned me once, he said, if you lose touch with your audience, they can lose touch with you with one click of the remote. And in such work, I think the imaginative element is hugely important, particularly on radio, because that's a medium where there are no images. Or more exactly, your words as a presenter must conjure up images in the listener's mind. That's how it works. Doing the radio history series on the history of America, I had to dig out anecdotes or quotations that illuminated academic points I wanted to make. Stories, really, human stories. Much source material is now on the internet, but I also spent many happy hours in North Wing Ground in the university library poring over books on American history. My rule of thumb was that if I found something that made me smile or brought tears to my eyes, another, if you like, Ottawa moment, then I had a chance of transmitting those emotions to the listener. Now, of course, a history of America over several centuries was an impossible endeavour. My rule of thumb, my assumption was that for every sentence I wrote, somebody else had written a doctoral thesis. But in a way, that was rather liberating because it had to be a personal view. Of course, it was in many ways superficial, and some academic colleagues were sniffy, and I think with justice. The other conclusion I drew was that I probably knew enough American history, the big picture of American history, to have a roadmap. I didn't know enough to realise how many potholes I was stepping into along the way. Anyway, it was enormous fun. And one of the most gratifying aspects was the emails from listeners. Now, a few were definitely abusive, but many were from appreciative people who said that they had hated history at school because it was dull and factual and what they were hearing was different from that. Or others who'd said, kind of revealingly, that they'd done a module on slavery and secession in the 1850s or on civil rights in the 1960s, but hadn't a clue where all that fitted in the larger picture. One email I particularly treasure was when it, for the last part of the last segment of this series, we on the 20th century were able to illustrate a programme with pictures, photographs, and put them on the website in company with the audio. And we did a programme about skyscrapers, Chicago, New York, around the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, featuring the Woolworth Building, which some of you may know in Lower Manhattan. And the website went up one morning, probably 9 o'clock in Britain, London, about lunchtime. I got an email from a man in Chicago, so it's early morning in Chicago. He'd already seen this. And he wrote to me and he said, "I want to thank you on behalf of my great-grandfather, August Ziesing. He ran the American Bridge Company for 25 years. In other words, he did the steel construction for the frame for these skyscrapers. He built the Tribune Tower here in Chicago. I believe the Woolworth Building is one of his best works." A few days after 9/11, he wrote, "I went down to see the Woolworth Building," when he was allowed back into that part of Manhattan. He said there wasn't a scratch on it. "I went to one of the corners and hugged it." I thought, it's worth doing a series just to get an email like that. Now, in our social media age, there are many ways of reaching out to audiences, apart from this kind of elaborate stuff of programs and so on. One of them that I think is particularly worthwhile is blogging. And if I can come back to our faculty website and go down the bottom, I'm trying to introduce my own colleagues to our faculty website, because probably most of them never look at it, as well as the general public. If you go down right to the bottom, you find very interesting things like history and policy, which sadly I don't have enough time to talk about. But one I want to just dwell on, you should look at it, because history and policy is fascinating as well, about the engagement with policy, of history with policymakers. But this one, Doing History in Public, is a blog site run by mostly graduate students here, writing short pieces about things that they have reflected on, lectures they've been to. There's one here, I think, on one of our public history seminars. Oh, yes, this one. We had a session last term about Mary, Queen of Scots and The Favourite, talking to the historical consultants. And blogging is a great way to loosen up doctoral students' writing style, to get them away from the ponderous scholastic prose of the PhD, and teaching them to write something. You know, it's kind of Daily Mail. You get the punch in the first couple of paragraphs, and you write something that's vivid. You have to attract people's attention. So that's a wonderful example, I think, of the ways in which students can loosen up on their writing. But I want to just end with a different faculty project, which, if I go back to the website, is featured actually right on the front page at the moment, Our Migration Story, which has now won 3 awards for research impact and engagement, looking at the history of this country through the diversity of the people who've come here over the centuries. It was funded by the AHRC. It's a web project developed here in Cambridge and also in Manchester, supported by the Runnymede Trust. Joy Chatterjee, Sundeep Lidder are the main figures here, and Sundeep has a blog about it. If we go to their own website, you can see what they're doing. This is a teaching tool intended to support a couple of GCSE courses now, looking at, you can read it for yourself, generations of migrants who came and shaped the British Isles, bringing together pieces of historical evidence, telling stories of individuals, over two millennia. This is another website you can play with on a wet day. It's fascinating, and you won't agree with everything that's here, but it's an example of how academic research can reach out to the wider public on an issue which is hugely important to our national self-understanding at the moment. Coming to terms with a country that is still, in many ways, deeply racist, yet also increasingly multicultural. And we haven't coped with either of those things properly. Okay, time to stop, or time to get on to questions and abuse from the audience. Let me just try and sum up very, very briefly. Speaking in Zurich in 1946, Winston Churchill, this is a Churchill quote now, so I'm just ticking the box. Winston Churchill asked, "Is the only lesson of history that mankind is unteachable? Is it the only lesson of history that mankind is unteachable?" I'm sure mankind is a typo. Actually, he meant humanity or humankind, but anyway. Well, hopefully not unteachable, but the teaching has to be repeated, refined, transformed across time, because teaching history, like all education, is an intergenerational process, and it's interactive. Generations learn each way, younger from older, older from younger. So what I've tried to say is doing that effectively means doing history which is scholarly rigorous, but which capitalizes on the unique and evolving self that each of us brings to the business, because we are all historical beings. And it also means writing and debating beyond the confines of academia, because informed history is part, as a vital part, of the public culture of a civilized society. I want to encourage you to explore the many meanings of the past and bring them to life in the present for the future. Seeing ourselves not as people who will write the definitive book, but as contributors to what the Dutch historian Peter Heil said was argument without end. And let's remember also the words of another Regius professor, this time from here, one of Chris's predecessors, George Macaulay Trevelyan, who lived at 23 West Road. I think is that part of the Selwyn Empire? Yes, that's right. You can see it on the plaque. It's right at the end of West Road by Grange Road. Trevelyan's a historian, not much in fashion now, but these words, I think, are ones that really stick for me. Written in the shadow of the Great War, about what he called the poetry of history. "The dead were and are not. Their place knows them no more, but is ours today. Yet they were once as real as we, and we shall tomorrow be shadows like them." I don't find that a depressing thing. I think it reminds us of what we should do as historians, to live, to read and write history to the full, within the, if you like, the existential moment that we have been given. And most of all, enjoy it. Thank you.